Your call is now live.
Oh, good afternoon. This is Kay Ganan. I'm program manager at the Security and Security Network. I'd like to welcome you to this call. We are co-sponsoring with the Constitution Project. Today, we are responding and providing comment and analysis on the Supreme Court's decision in Holder versus Humanitarian Law Project this morning. The speakers will be Sharon Bradford Franklin, Senior Counsel at the Constitution Project. She's a prominent civil liberties attorney working on national security issues with the Constitution Project's Bipartisan Liberty and Security Commission. Ahalan Arulanantham is Director of Immigrants' Rights and National Security at the ACLU of Southern California and has successfully represented U.S. citizens wrongfully detained as enemy combatants and has worked on material support issues in the context of humanitarian aid. I will also speak. I coordinate the Charity and Security Network's efforts to reform national security laws that create barriers to legitimate charities. And at the end, we will have comments of Professor Stephen Vladek of the Washington College of Law at American University read to us. Professor Vladek is out of the country and unavailable for the call, but emailed in his comments. So after these short presentations, we'll open up for question and answer. So with this, I would like to start with Sharon Bradford Franklin.
Thank you, Kay. As I'm sure you all know, the court today rejected the constitutional challenge brought by the Humanitarian Law Project and other plaintiffs. And the groups had challenged the overbroad application of laws prohibiting material support for groups designated as terrorist organizations. These groups sought to provide peacebuilding and human rights training to some designated groups, and basically to engage in pure speech furthering lawful, nonviolent ends. But the court today found that it does not violate the Constitution to criminalize such speech. Last fall, the Constitution Project had released a report on reforming the material support laws, making a number of specific recommendations for reform. And we also filed an amicus brief in support of the plaintiffs in this case, along with the Rutherford Institute. So we are severely disappointed by today's decision. I just, in my opening, want to make two brief remarks about today's decision. First, about the nature of the review applied by the court, and second, briefly, about its effect. On the nature of the review, the majority did say it was rejecting the intermediate scrutiny standard that the government had suggested, but even under the more demanding standard that the court states it's applying, while they did certainly cite a compelling government interest in countering terrorism, the majority doesn't really show how barring this type of aid, this type of pure speech, is really narrowly tailored to serve this interest, or even how it's closely related to the aim of countering terrorism. They apply a broad fungibility analysis. This is something that's come up in the context of providing funding, where they say it frees up other resources. But the majority doesn't really explain how this freeing up resources works in the context of training for human rights aims and for pursuing peaceful means, and really only speculates on how that would happen. And along this lines, the majority talks about demanding deference to the political branches in making such findings, but there really aren't any actual findings by either Congress or the executive branch that they cite to on how this type of aid, this pure speech and human rights training, would free up resources or somehow further terrorism. And they speak really only to the prospect of harm. Second point is just on the actual effect of this decision. We believe this is actually counterproductive, and in terms of serving our government's interest in countering terrorism, it would actually be beneficial to have groups on the ground teaching designated terrorist organizations how to lay down their arms and instead pursue peaceful means, and that type of training would actually be something we would want to encourage rather than criminalizing. So I'll be happy to take questions on any of these points during the Q&A. Thank you.
Thank you, Sharon. Next, Ahalan Arulanantham will speak.
Good afternoon, everyone. And I should add, I'm the Director of Immigrants' Rights and National Security at the ACLU in Los Angeles, but I also worked in the immediate aftermath of the tsunami in Sri Lanka as a relief volunteer there back in 2004, 2005. and got a chance to see a lot of the way this law works firsthand during that time. I think the decision will be very, very disappointing to groups doing humanitarian work. The court didn't take the opportunity to rule explicitly on whether it's lawful to prohibit the provision of shelter, medical equipment, and certain other kinds of basic assistance during natural disasters, such as the tsunami in 2004. But of course, groups doing such work, when they read this opinion, they're going to be left with, at a very minimum, I think, more fear and more uncertainty around the provision of such vital humanitarian assistance, certainly than they had before today's decision. And the court focused very heavily on the idea that independent support is permissible to a group, while coordinated support with that group is not permissible. But on the hardest question, which is where do you draw the line between coordinated support and independent support, the court really refused to provide any guidance at all. And as we've seen in the campaign finance context, the Federal Election Commission has found it almost impossible to determine when action by an independent but supportive group is coordinated with a political candidate and when it's not. And for the people who are working in conflict zones, you know, their experiences teach us that the line is certainly no easier to draw in that world than it is in the world of campaign finance. So as a result of the decision today, innocent victims of natural disasters, victims of protracted civil conflicts, and other people who really through no fault of their own remain desperately in need of humanitarian assistance, they will find it more difficult to survive as a result of today's decision. And you know, remembering back to the things that I saw back in the immediate aftermath of the tsunami, I just cannot believe that the justices would have reached this result if they had been able to see the victims of violence and disaster whose lives their decision will so adversely affect today. So it's a very disappointing decision.
Thank you, Ahilan. Next, the comments of Professor Stephen Bladick will be read by Suraj Sazawal of the Charity and Security Network. And at the end of the press conference, I can give you Professor Vladek's email address, and he can take your questions that way, and we'll answer them as soon as he is able.
Thank you, Kay. Yes, these are the comments of Stephen L. Vladek, Professor of Law at American University, Washington College of Law. His comments are, in holding that the statute is not vague to the extent that it prohibits the provision of service, training, and expert advice or assistance, the majority effectively accepted the government's argument that virtually any support for these groups is within Congress's constitutional power to prohibit. Even the most benign forms of speech could be punished under the statute, a result that will likely have a profound chilling effect on the efforts of peace-building organizations and other NGOs that seek to promote nonviolent democracy-building measures vis-a-vis these groups through teaching and other advocacy training. At oral argument, the government even suggested that the filing of an amicus brief on behalf of one of these designated foreign terrorist organizations might fall within the scope of the statute. The court today seems to have endorsed such a potentially limitless view of what it means to provide support to these groups. Perhaps the most important implications of the decision becomes apparent when one reads Justice Breyer's dissent. Although the court's rejection of HLP's vagueness challenges will have profound effects on the peace-building efforts of various NGOs, the more long-term effects of today's decision will likely center on the court's rejection of the First Amendment freedom of association to claim. It has been the law of the land since 1961 that the Constitution prohibits the imposition of guilt by association. Here, the court concluded that the statute requires more than just mere association with a designated foreign terrorist organization, and so survives First Amendment scrutiny. But given the first part of the opinion, which endorsed an incredibly broad view of what it means to support these groups, the line between support and mere membership will be incredibly thin going forward. That ends his comments.
Thank you. Professor Vladek's email address is on the press release. It's also S, V as in Victor, A-L-D-E-C-K, at wcl.american.edu. And then this is Kay Ganan, the last speaker. And I'd like to comment on what is likely to happen going forward or what needs to happen going forward. Because despite finding that material support criminalizes pure speech that normally would be protected by the First Amendment, the court deferred to Congress and the executive branch findings that such support can facilitate the violent activities of a terrorist organization, even when by its character it is purely nonviolent and is in fact intended to turn the group away from violence. The court cited a provision of 2939B when it passed Congress that put this statement into the congressional record, as well as an affidavit from the Department of State that made the same general claim. However, the research I've conducted indicates that there is nothing in the congressional record that is, provides any factual basis for these broad conclusions. And in fact, they appear to be wholly unsupported, hypothetical, and theoretical. And while there may be instances that such support could indirectly support violent activities of a terrorist organization, it does not make practical sense that that happens in every case or in all cases. So what needs to happen going forward to protect free speech and promote our interests in building peace around the world is for Congress and the executive branch to engage in some real and responsible fact-finding to determine what circumstances and when such indirect support might actually take place, and then how rules can be narrowly tailored to allow for otherwise legitimate speech and humanitarian activities and preventing that kind of indirect benefit. So the responsible thing for Congress and the White House to do now is to move forward and make that kind of factual determination. And I think now we are ready to take your questions.
At this time, if you do have a question, please press the number one key on your touch-tone phone. Only press the number one time, or you will be removed from the queue. Our first question comes from Theo Emery from the Congressional Quarterly.
Yes, good afternoon. I have a two-pronged question. One was Justice Stevens joined the majority on this case, making it 6-3, and I wanted to ask, is there anything about that decision that strikes you, and did it surprise you? And the second question is, looking forward, Elena Kagan's nomination starts on Monday, and I wanted to ask whether this ruling in any way has any kind of impact on her candidacy to be the next justice, and, you know, will her questions to her be affected by this ruling in any way, in your view?
Does anyone want to take that? This is Sharon Bradford Frankel at the Constitution Project. I would just say, first of all, yes, I am surprised that Justice Stevens joined the majority, and also very disappointed that Justice Stevens joined the majority in this opinion. As far as the questions to Elena Kagan for her nomination, I don't know that this will change anything. We certainly hope that the senators will ask her questions about her views on national security and executive power, but they should do that regardless of this decision.
Thank you.
At this point, we have no further questions. Take that back. Somebody just raised their hand. I have Kenneth Jost with the CQ Press. Go ahead, Kenneth.
It's Jost. What is your view of prosecutions that have been initiated to date under this law? And do your organizations fear that, in fact, with this decision, prosecutions will be initiated against them or the individuals?
This is Kay Ganan. At this point, it's not clear what position the government's going to take and prosecutions going forward, but Solicitor General Kagan did decline to say that there would be no prosecution of Ralph Fertig and the leaders of the Humanitarian Law Project in connection with their activities in the case. That happened during the oral argument. So given the vigorous argument the government made in favor of its interpretation in the law, It's certainly not unreasonable for peacebuilding organizations to be very concerned.
This is Sharon Braxton Franklin. I would just add that I think perhaps the bigger problem is the continuing chilling effect of this kind of activity, of First Amendment protected speech, and how NGOs have to continue to be very careful, perhaps more careful now, about what work they can do and can't do. So even if they manage to avoid prosecution, this is really going to be risky for them, and they're going to have to really figure out very carefully what aid they're comfortable engaging in.
This is Ahil and Arlana. I'm just adding on to that. I think that the decision will have the effect of decreasing the amount of humanitarian assistance provided, whether or not there's ever a single prosecution for the provision of such assistance, for precisely the reasons that, you know, Sharon said. The groups are, charitable organizations are, you know, by nature risk averse. So the group, the decision will be harmful whether or not it results in particular prosecutions.
This is Kay. Again, I would add that even if there's not a criminal prosecution, a charitable organization or any U.S. organization can be listed as a supporter of terrorism as a result of engaging in material support, or what's defined as material support, and all of its assets will be seized and frozen, and it's effectively shut down. And this can and has happened without criminal charges ever being filed, and the appeal procedures are extremely minimal. So that adds to the chilling impact.
Okay, at this time we have no further questions. Oh, now we do. I have Dave Soldina with Rethink Media. Go ahead, Dave.
Hi, thanks. My question is, What sort of impact does this decision have on peaceful outreach? So say for instance, there were a lot of U.S.-based organizations that participated in the behind-the-scenes negotiations that led to, for instance, the Good Friday Accords that drew peace between Sinn Féin, the IRA, the Orange Order, and were generally very helpful in resolving that peace process. What do you suppose is going to be the result of similar organizations' work in, for instance, the Middle East and the Palestinian-Israeli situation?
This is Ahil and Arlana. I think that's a fine example of the short-sightedness of the decision today, because obviously in many instances peace-building works to mitigate violence and works to counter terrorism, and decision today will make it, in some cases, impossible, and I think at the very least, much more difficult for groups to engage in that kind of activity.
This is Sharon Braxton Franklin. I would agree, and you know, beyond the chilling effect we've been talking about, it takes you back to the analysis in the court's opinion. If you actually want to further this compelling government interest of countering terrorism, you know, this is a counterproductive approach, and the better way to further it would be to permit groups to engage in this type of human rights training and assistance.
This is Kay. I would add that under the law, the Secretary of State does have the power to create exemptions to many of these parts of the definition of material support, and she could do so in a way that could encourage this kind of peace-building activity. So the power to fix this problem that the Supreme Court has created for all of us is there with the Secretary of State, and can choose to create an exemption that could be specific as to how the activities would be carried out. But the State Department has recognized that non-governmental organizations can get into discussions and have access to people that government cannot. And as you pointed out with the Sinn Féin example, help get peace negotiations rolling.
At this time, we have no further questions. Once again, if you do have a question, please press 1 on your touch-tone phone. And it looks like we do have a question from Caroline Preston. from the Chronicle of Philanthropy. Go ahead, Caroline.
Thank you very much. Kay, I wanted to follow up on that last point that you made. I mean, do some exemptions exist, and how much willingness has the Secretary of State indicated she might have it in creating those?
I don't know how much willingness the Secretary of State will have at this time, but now that this case is concluded, there's certainly no reason to sit back and let U.S. peacebuilding organizations be forced out of activities that could be helpful in their approach of the 3Ds of defense development and security. So I hope that the State Department will take a look at this and consider its position. Unfortunately, the State Department did submit that affidavit to the court in the Humanitarian Law Project case, making the broad general claim about indirect benefit to violent activities that peacebuilding can provide. I think, like Congress, the Secretary of State needs to do a factual assessment of that and not just accept the myth.
This is Ahilan Arulanandam. I would just add that the waiver authority was in existence, although it had just recently been enacted prior to the tsunami, and obviously wasn't invoked at that time, despite the tsunami having hit eastern Sri Lanka, a large area which was controlled by the LTTE. It was also in place when the earthquake struck Pakistan, and again wasn't invoked at that time either. But hopefully, you know, a different administration and this decision will cause the State Department to take a closer look at it.
And this is Sharon Bradford Franklin. I just also wanted to add that, you know, this challenge to these provisions of the material support laws that were before the court are not the only flaws that various NGOs have cited with these overbroad laws. There are also a host of other problems, including the lack of real due process protections for groups that are designated as terrorist organizations to be able to challenge those findings, and a variety of other problems with these laws. So there will be a lot of work, advocacy work, with Congress and the executive branch to try and bring about those reforms.
And at this time, we have no further questions. It looks like we have no further questions. Did you want me to officially close the call?
Okay, it looks like we're done, unless any of the speakers have any final remarks.
So, thank you.
Thank you all.
Thank you.
Officially ends our call. Have a great afternoon.
Thank you.